So I don't know about all of you, but I was going through my best of the year list here for 2017, and I thought I'd look back at my older lists to see how they held up, and I was kind of surprised by some of the things that I found on my list. And it's not that I don't like the new pornographers, but actually seeing my list have like the number three album in whatever year as new pornographers, I thought, I haven't listened to that album in ages. And so I'm here with Stephen Thompson, Marissa LaRusso, and Robin Hilton, and thinking about like what makes an album last? What makes an album great? What makes you want to go back and listen? These are some of the questions we're going to answer. We'll start right here. These are the Shins.
Called to see if your back was still aligned and your sheets were growing grass all on the corners of your bed. But you got too much to wear on your sleeves. It has too much to do with me. And secretly I want to bury in the yard the gray remains of a friendship scar.
Robin Hilton, this came out in 2003. This is The Shins. This is from Shoots Too Narrow, the song Kissing the Lipless. If this came out 14 years later, if this came out in 2017, is a question you were asking around, Robin, would this album be on your top 10?
Yes.
Okay. End of it. Okay.
Conversation. End of discussion. Yeah.
No, actually, we were talking with NPR music editor Jacob Gantz before doing this show, and he said, you know, like, would this record matter if it came out now? Because this sort of music isn't what people are, you know, most people aren't listening to this kind of music right now. But I don't know. Hearing it right now, I think it's pretty great and still holds up after almost 15 years. But yeah, I think that's an interesting question to consider, whether, you know, the timing of a record, when it comes out, what it's up against, because there are like, you know, some riff rock records or things like that that maybe don't. I've thought of some bands, like if this band came out, you know, was making music in 1968, this would be the number one record. Like the band Foxygen, I thought, I love their music, but I thought, it doesn't feel that special right now, but if it were 1967 or 68, that would probably be a number one record.
I would just say, too, I think part of the appeal with The Shins, at least when that record came out, it felt fresh. Mm-hmm. And I feel like now to hear, I mean, perhaps if I heard that record for the first time in 2017, it would still feel fresh. But there are 1,000 other bands who are trying to do what The Shins did. And so I don't know how well it would do if it came out in 2017 as some hip new band that you had never heard of.
I think one thing that happens a lot is you have to contextualize these records not only in terms of the music scene around them, but where you are in your life. I mean, so many of my top 10 lists, and I went back, looked at my top 10 lists back going back like 20 years, and so many of my favorites, I could feel kind of where they fit into my life at the time. And obviously that's going to be different for every single person, but as my life has changed, I'm not the same person I was 10 years or 20 years ago.
So if I play this, Stephen, this is Noah and the Whale. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows where they are today. We don't.
Jeez.
They broke up. Yeah, Noah and the Whale made my favorite album of 2009, The First Days of
Number
Spring.
One.
Number one album of the year. And I still, like, if I were to listen to this record right now, I would say, I love this record. I think it's gorgeous. But this is a very specific breakup record. And the feelings that it evokes are very specific, I think, to the end of a relationship. And though I didn't get divorced until like a whole year later, I still associate this record with the feelings of loss. And not necessarily in that kind of general way. If you listen to another breakup record, like say, For Emma Forever Ago by Bon Iver, which was my favorite album of 2008, that album is vague enough that it still feels universal, and I don't necessarily associate it with specific things or specific emotions that were going on in my life. It's just beautiful and warm, and it brings up different feelings for me at different times. This Noah and the Whale record, I would recommend as an amazing breakup record, but it's past its usefulness to me, and I've almost entirely not gone back and revisited it.
I was wondering, though, if an artist falls off the radar for mm-hmm. whatever reason, either they break up or they stop making great music.
Sure.
Does that affect how you look back on who they are?
Oh, absolutely. And I think in the case of Noah and the Whale, I didn't really care for their subsequent records as much as this one. This record to me felt like this perfect jewel, and then they got a little bit kind of synth poppier, and they didn't click with me nearly as hard. And I think that's a huge factor.
It makes you go back and, like, are you saying you question whether the album you thought was so great was as great as you thought it was?
Oh, I never question my opinions, Rob.
But I mean, if you say what comes after it matters, are you saying it casts a shadow over what came before it?
Or
the record that you originally loved?
Yeah, and I'll talk about another record in a little bit that's even stronger. But very often, your perspective shifts as you hear more and more of what an artist has. If an artist has kind of that one great record and then their subsequent records bore you to tears, I'm not nearly as inclined to go back and revisit the one that I loved.
I want to play this. I'm looking at Marissa LaRusso. I'm playing Hop Along. It's 2012. Well, it was 2012.
I'm not really a list maker, but I think if I was a list maker in 2012, this would have been my number one record. And it's a record that I still listen to all the time, Get Disowned by Hop Along. I feel like I have yet to hear someone sing the way that Frances Quinlan sings on this record. And if you think you found someone, I don't want to hear it.
clearly you haven't listened.
Thank you for that mansplaining, everyone. And they've put out a record since called Painted Shut, which came out in 2014, I think. That was a great record, but it's not my favorite. I thought that Get Disowned was kind of weirder and a little bit rougher around the edges, and that's why I go back to it. So I'm kind of curious to see what Hop Along does next and how maybe that might change the way that I look at these first two records.
Have you gone back to look at what else came out in 2012 and thought maybe this actually would have been my number one instead? Or is this one sort of imprinted on itself?
This one
on
is
you?
Just really emotionally imprinted on me, I think. Like, I wouldn't make the claim that it's the best record that came out that year. I'm sure there are ones that are more critically acclaimed and spoke to a greater number of people. But for me, it's the one that spoke to me the loudest.
Well, and that's how, I mean, at least for myself, that's how I always do top 10 lists. I always do it as personal preference instead of like, this is the quote unquote best.
Yeah, I've tried to be a little more objective as I've gotten older because there are years where my favorite record isn't what I have to concede is the best record of a given year. Except for in the case of this one.
This is here because of Robin Hilton.
Wait for it. You gotta wait for it.
So you're
it's Motley Crue.
And you're what, 4 years old?
I'm 14 when this record came out. I swore to that. This is the title cut to Shout at the Devil by Motley Crue. So another one of the things we talked about around this was when do you reach a point in your life where you trust yourself to make that call that this is the best record? of a given year. And full disclosure, I've never told anybody this in my current life. So Stephen, Marissa, Bob, that's a confession that
nobody else.
I bought this record because I thought it was the most awesome thing I'd ever heard in my entire life. I was 14 years old. I listened to it nonstop until my friends, who were a lot cooler, just hazed me mercilessly over this record, and I tossed
why? Why would
it,
they do that? Folks, why
and I gave it up, and like, you know, like at the time I was kind of offended, you know, that they thought they knew better. but the truth is they knew better, and in retrospect I really shouldn't have been making that call. Somebody needed to wrest that control away from me and not let me pick this as the best record of 1983.
Which you actually did for NPR.
Yes.
Do you all remember your 14-year-old favorite?
Oh, man. I mean, mine was way worse. I was listening to that like, yeah, this is pretty rocking. I think Shadow of the Devil is a great song.
The advantage of being old is that I got Sgt. Pepper at 14.
Right, exactly. You monster. No, I mean, for me, I mean, 1980... When was Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet? 87?
Oh, great pick.
That was my favorite album of 87. I was really into the soft rock band Chicago when I was early to mid-teens. So like even like post Peter Cetera, like Chicago 18, I thought that record was amazing. You listen to that record now, it is moist garbage.
Ugh, did you have to use that word? That is the worst word.
But it was my favorite album. I mean, so clearly somewhere along the way, I'd like to think I've developed better tastes, but that was my favorite at that time.
I think when I was a teenager at that time, I almost exclusively listened to Paramore, who I would mm-hmm. still stand by,
sure.
and Dave Matthews Band, who I have not really gone back to visit, but I was really, really into Dave Matthews Band as a teen.
No shame.
Yeah.
No shame, no shade.
No shame, no shade, but also just not really my taste anymore.
Yeah.
Robin, to your question, I'm genuinely curious at what age people learn to trust their own taste. I'm 25, and I...
Not yet. No, I'm just kidding.
That was a you can't trust yourself yet.
Oh, I see. Yeah, well, no, but I don't. I'm 25, and I don't trust my own taste. I think there's maybe also a gendered angle to it. I think women are frequently told that their taste is not as legitimate as the mansplainers in the room often.
In this room.
In this particular room, no. But I think in general that's a thing, too. So I would love to hear your experiences.
Well, let me tell you a little bit.
Thank you.
Just about that age thing. We live many lives, and that's one thing that I thought. I went back to my top 10 lists all the way back to the 80s, too, Stephen. I thought, oh, my gosh, we live so many lives, and the person I am now is not the person I was in the 90s or the 80s, except for Shout at the Devil, which...
I think for me, it got less questionable around, like, 17, 18. Marissa, at 25, you were smarter than I am at 45. so I don't think that's an issue. But I think, like, once I started getting into music that I now consider great, you know, so, like, Tracy Chapman's first record was a really, really big one for me. I started college in 1990 and, like, kind of started working for the college radio station. Once I had, like, friends who were inundating me with kind of cool music... I feel like there was a kind of a turn made around late teens, and I'm guessing if you came up listening to Paramore and Dave Matthews Band, you're way ahead of where I was when you were listening to in the equivalent of when you were listening to those records.
Well, I think one of the things is the music that you're getting, music that just happens to be out there, or is it music you are going to seek? And I think mm-hmm. it's the music. Mm-hmm. At what point in your life do you start seeking music and you start finding things that have is common to your own personality, and we all do that at different ages.
I am shocked by how astute that is. I think that's. I think
well, what you have available, you can only do what you can with what you have,
right.
And you know, all I heard was what was played on the one radio station we got, and it was hair metal.
You and I were both small. We're both small towners.
Yeah,
I mean, I grew up in a town of 1,300, and so I had what was on pop radio. Until I, you know, figured out how to ride my bike to the record store. 13 miles away.
I was going to say, you had a record store?
13 miles away.
Uphill both ways.
Uphill both ways.
I think it's also interesting that you bring that up because one of the first records that I remember really seeking out and falling in love with is one that I still listen to a lot today, which is I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning by Bright Eyes.
Sure.
Do you remember what set you off looking for it?
My sister had a boyfriend who loved Bright Eyes, and he was like a cool guy. And so he recommended that we also listen to Bright Eyes and kind of got us into the whole Saddle Creek roster, which was definitely a cool thing to like when I was, 13 or however old.
Did you all of a sudden become 13 again right here?
Yeah, exactly.
To come to the little notes.
I know that it is freezing, but I think we have to walk. I keep waving at the taxis, they keep turning their lights off. Julie knows a party at some actor's west side loft. Supplies are endless in the evening, by the morning they'll be gone.
Boy, this still sounds great, huh?
Right. And Connor Oberst put out this album on the same day as an album called Digital Ash and a Digital Urn, which was kind of a more electronic album. And I think I remember liking that one better, but I think mostly it was because whenever I put it on, my mom was like, God, this sounds like the 80s. And so, whatever pisses off your parents the most is what you end up loving.
Absolutely.
I don't know, finding this record at 13, I mean, you say you still don't trust yourself. I mean, I thought the Hop-Along was pretty awesome, too. I think these are pretty great records. I wouldn't disagree with these picks at all, and I think they hold up.
I'll take an MP3 of that and just listen to it every day to psych myself up.
It's too bad it was Robin, though. Like, talk about whether to trust an opinion.
Oh, I see.
Speaking of trust and opinion, if I played this for Robin... Look at his face. Can you describe his face, Marissa?
It seems almost aggressively neutral.
I'm drifting off. It's taking me.
Listen as the wind blows from across the great divide. Voices trapped in yearning.
Don't you dare pull this down yet. You have to wait.
What was that? I couldn't hear
Just
you.
Wait.
The night is my companion, and solitude my guide. Would I spend forever here and not be satisfied? And I would be the one to hold.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Sarah McLachlan, this is from her record Fumbling Toward Ecstasy. So in the 90s, and I talked about living many lives, I went through this huge Lilith Fair phase in the 90s where I was listening to like Jewel and Paula Cole,
sure.
Sarah McLachlan. In retrospect, this record came out in 93. If I went back and looked at some of the other records that came out that year, In Utero from Nirvana came out that year, Siamese Dream came out, Bjork's debut solo record came out that year. So maybe I would have picked those in retrospect, but...
as your album of the year.
as my album of the year. But I still think the Sarah McLachlan record's a great record. I don't know that it deserves to be the best for 93, but the life that I was living through much of the 90s, in fact, I went back and picked my number one records from all these past year, or wrote them all down. 95 would have probably been Jagged Little Pill, maybe, by Alanis Morissette, or it would have been Jules' Pieces of You. It's a toss-up. I'm not really sure.
And now you think...
Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness came out that year. PJ Harvey's To Bring You My Love came out that year, which was pretty incredible.
Yep.
So you put Jewel over.
Was
that on your application?
Jagged Little Pill stands up.
That
though.
Does.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it, even though Jagged Little Pill had some noise on it, I think part of it was. I wasn't going through a loud, noisy, harsh phase in the 90s like a lot of my friends were. I was going through more of a introspective, kind of quieter, more melancholy music. And I came to all the louder stuff much later. Like, I love Nirvana. I love Smashing Pumpkins. But I wasn't listening to them when they were super huge at the time. I came to them years later.
If a record doesn't hold up over time, is it the record's fault? I mean...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I have an example from 1995, and I think that Sarah McLachlan record is a great record, by the way. My favorite album of 1995 was an album called Sparkle and Fade by Everclear.
So I played the top of this song, and it has been stuck in my head for the last 3 or 4 hours. It's so maddening. Bam, bam. Back.
I am still living with your ghost.
Poor Bob. Poor Bob.
I didn't have to live through this.
Bob was born in 97. He's just a newborn baby. Big black boots and an
old suitcase.
Wow.
I think it's the record's fault.
This reminds me of like when Blues Traveler was like awesome, right?
I loved this record. I thought this record was...
Was that love or loved? I couldn't tell.
I loved this record. I think that...
Do you still love it?
I mean, I still... It rock, first of all, it really rocks out in the choruses. But this record, to me, I think what I was blinded to is what came out in subsequent Everclear records, where... he became, I don't know if this is the most NPR way of putting this, but he became kind of douchier with each subsequent record. Kind of this like smug, kind of smarmy, he kind of took on this kind of like, kind of unctuous, kind of like huckster persona that I found really whatever the opposite of winning is, and it kind of in hindsight ruined this record for me and made me think like, oh my god, what was I ever thinking? Now listening back, I can hear the things I
don't
like.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I wonder, since Bob didn't listen then, I wonder, do you hear all of that in this song, even though Stephen
I just can't, I don't even know, can you describe that face?
It's like
you swallowed something sour.
I just couldn't for a minute. Like that first note, I didn't know this song, and I missed a lot of. I stopped listening to the radio, music on the radio in 1975.
We're learning a lot about each other.
Yeah, yeah. So pop. So
how
music
did you get
coming
this job?
At me. Yeah, no, that's a good question. So music coming at me. It was always seeking. It was all. So I would never have heard that song. And this was. Thank you. Really, so much, Stephen.
I mean, this was the one when I went back. I think I went back to like 92. Yeah. And a lot of those picks, Lemonheads, It's a Shame About Ray, that is a great record. That was my favorite album in 1992. I found a lot of them. That was the only one that for me completely clanked as, wow, that was a miss. That was a miss.
You know what I was thinking of when we were talking about The Shins and what you were saying about that record being out of time or like if it came out now, Marissa. I started thinking like, what about... the opposite, if one of the band's more recent records came out 15 years ago, would the opposite be true? Like, The Shins had a record out this year called Heartworms, and I haven't spent as much time with it as I spent with the early Shins records, but what if it had come out 15 years ago? Would it have, you know, is there just not a place for that record now in the landscape when you have a record like Damn coming out? Mm-hmm. You know, is there just not really room for a record like that? Because the Shins sound hasn't really evolved much. I mean, it's the Shins record today is pretty much what a Shins record was 15 years ago.
Yeah, I just think the song craft was sharper on those first couple records. I mean, I listened to that Shins record this year and nothing registered with me. So some of it is, I think, familiarity. But when you started playing Kissing the Lipless at the top of this episode, I thought, boy, this sounds, I was like, oh, is this the Neutral Milk Hotel record that Marissa wanted to play? but then it was also like, oh no, this is just a really, really sharp song. I love this song. And I didn't have that feeling. I mean, some of it's probably familiarity, but I didn't have that feeling with the new Shins record.
Let's take a short break and come back and we'll talk more about this. We're talking about what makes an album great and look at your top 10 list. Do they hold up? But more after this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from iZotope, makers of Spire Studio, the portable multi-track recording system that lets you easily capture, mix, and edit professional quality songs wherever and whenever inspiration strikes. With built-in Wi-Fi, Spire Studio seamlessly connects to the Spire app, so you can ditch the cables and collaborate and share with bandmates and fans around town or around the world. Learn more at spire.live.
Support also comes from Lyft, reminding listeners that they could be relaxing in a Lyft ride right now, with their eyes closed, listening to Beethoven, or whale sounds, or a babbling brook, or something else relaxing. Lyft provides rides as relaxing as the buttery smooth voice of a public radio announcer, because riding is just a more relaxing way to drive. Lyft, it matters how you get there. Download and ride today.
I'm here with Stephen Thompson, Marissa LoRusso, and Robin Hilton. We're talking about music that stands the test of time in many ways. And I was thinking about you guys
or
are
not.
Playing, or not. You all were playing things from when you were in your, well, Marissa's age now, in your middle 20s. Remember that, guys? And
do you remember that, Marissa?
And mine was longer ago than that, and I was trying to think about Judgment and all that stuff. I just quickly went to a year, in this case, would have been 78, I think, when this record came out. I'm going to play something that I was in love with when I was that age and see how this holds up. It's a Gang of Four, for those who don't know. At home, feels like a tourist.
Well, you're just a little bit cooler than all the rest of us, I guess, if that's what you were listening to when you were 25.
I mean, I just felt, I think musically, I feel so fortunate because in my teen years was the late 60s, and in my 20s was the late 70s, and I thought they were very rich. And when I'm thinking about what makes this sound, if this came out today, I think I'd still love it madly. And I think it, even though at the time when it came out, there was nothing else that sounded like that. And I think that's something that helps a record's longevity and why you come back to it. Whereas the Bon Iver record, like you said before, I think it was a singular record. And No and the Wales was a good record that sounded like other records, right?
I don't know that as much that it sounded like other records, just that it was very specific.
Okay.
And I think specificity can make a record, wow, this is completely, this. It can make it feel like this record is unique. But it could also, like, so much of where I connect to records is through emotions. Mm-hmm. So I hear Gang of Four, I'm like, oh, this is a great sounding record that doesn't really penetrate. Like it does, like it's, I mean, I'm not saying it's not a good record. It's a great record. But I'm not, it's not accessing emotions.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of these things, like Marissa was saying before about picking favorites instead of best, you know, I think this is like a record that I think, oh, wow, this sounds great. I would listen to this in any number of settings, but I'm not going to like put it on under headphones. I'm not going to necessarily like, I'm not going to feel... I'm not going to get up in my feelings to this record. And a lot of the stuff that I pick and a lot of the stuff that lasts for me is stuff that accesses emotions.
It's about you.
It's about me personally, Stephen Thompson, and that's how I expect everybody else to relate to everything.
Do you feel like things last, Stephen, if they access emotions that you are still tapping into right now? Or do you think that if you listen to a record and it brings you back to a really particular feeling that maybe you're not up in your feelings about right now, does that still feel like it lasts?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's kind of what I was saying about the Noah and the Whale record, is mm-hmm. I don't feel like that anymore, and so I don't feel a need to pull out that record, as opposed to a record that I brought from 2012, my favorite album of 2012, tapped into something very, very specific, but it's something that I can go back to again and again. That album is called Celebration Rock by Japandroids, an album about by like two dudes who are rocking out, and all their songs are about like holding on to the feeling of being young. And
let it go, Stephen.
Okay.
love the glee on his face. If only we had a film of this. He was lip syncing. You look 5 years younger.
Guys, I'm just rocking out.
I found 2012 to be kind of a fuzzy year. I picked the Cat Power record Sun for my number one that year. Maybe in retrospect I would have picked Patrick Watson, maybe. I don't know, but I actually looked at my entire top 10 from that year and there wasn't a single one that I thought, oh, definitely, that's...
See, to me, and I looked at this and I thought, oh my God, this record is amazing. I'm so glad I picked it for number one. I completely stand by it. And then I looked at my list and Channel Orange by Frank Ocean was inexplicably number two and is a much better record. But I stand by both of them. They're both great. But this is an example of something where I turned 40 the year this record came out. It touched me in that special way of dude approaching obsolescence, still wanting to rock out a little bit. I connected to this record on that level. I can access that much more easily. It's not so event specific in my life.
The thing that you were talking about, the personal and how that means so much to you, and I was thinking about the Gang of Four song as that was playing, and the Gang of Four song had nothing to do with the personal. It was all about the political. Mm-hmm. And yet I still feel completely connected to it and the times that were happening and the poverty that existed. And they were writing about those times of poverty and the class struggles in England. I don't know. It's funny because that's not like it's a different emotional.
Sure.
But it's still a major connection for me.
Yeah, and I've had that connection to other. I mean, I mentioned Tracy Chapman before. Right. That Tracy Chapman record is very steeped in the details of people's lives and people struggling and striving in ways that I was not struggling and striving as a 16-year-old in Iola, Wisconsin. But I found a much easier path into the emotion of that record, and that's right. that's just a personal taste thing as much as anything else.
I'm gonna play this. Give the kids, for they don't know how to live. Run the alleys casually, You were probably 18, Marissa, when this. You had the biggest smile. So.
Yeah, and I picked this record to talk about today too. This is "Strange Mercy" by Saint Vincent, because she put out a record this year that I didn't love quite as much, mm-hmm. and I think shows her moving in a very different musical direction. And I think Robin, you were talking earlier about what does an artist's trajectory kind of change the way that you look back on their older records? And I think that's part of why I love Strange Mercy so much, is that it takes all of the kind of like weirdo art rock, weird crazy guitar stuff that she was doing on her early records, but it's super catchy and it's got these crazy good hooks and this like pop mentality that you can tell Annie Clark is a total genius of. And she's kind of abandoned the weirder mm-hmm. side on her newer records. And so for me, Strange Mercy is the pinnacle of both super weird and super catchy. Yeah. And maybe if she goes back to the weird stuff in the future, Strange Mercy won't feel like it's held up for me as much anymore. But for me, it really seems like kind of the pinnacle of Saint Vincent.
You make me think of another phenomenon where maybe weaker records in an artist's catalog make you rethink the early records. I think the opposite is true, where I like St. Vincent fine, but it wasn't until she released her self-titled record that just completely floored me. And now when I go back and hear some of the early stuff, I realize, wow, it was a lot better than I thought it was. I now am able to hear, you know, her self-titled record flag the things that she does really, really well, and I started noticing it more in her earlier stuff.
I think that's exactly right. I've had a very, very similar experience with her, and I think my reaction to the new record was just like, I want all those guitars.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think she's one of the best living guitarists. Play that up, man.
She's hands down one of the greatest rock guitarists right now. Like what she did on her self-titled record with the guitar, I mean, it truly, it was just mind-bending. Like you could not believe that it was a guitar she was playing.
In one way, people are saying that What makes a great record hold up is somewhat the personal, and how the artist is looked at and judged in later years in terms of their output. Yeah.
Carrie and Lowell by Sufjan Stevens that came out in 2015, it really speaks to that for me. I mean, I think it's unquestionably a phenomenal record on every level, but when I listened to it and when it came out and when I went to see him live, it
the
was,
one that you wept
I
a lot
I sobbed
at.
Through the entire show. And it was just days before my daughter was born, and I know that that had to be playing in my mind and my heart at the time I was taking all this music in, because the whole record's about his troubled relationship with his mother, who abandoned him when he was only a year old. And you know, I think for a record to truly stand the test of time, it's got to find a way to weave itself into your DNA. And this record will never leave me. And I will always love it and think it's amazing.
The jury's still out on your actual kid, though.
Yeah, she's a monster.
Under the bare tree, shadows and light conspiring. Covered bridge ice cream. Cottage grove shade.
You know, he kind of returns to his roots as a gentle-voiced neo-folk singer on this record. But, and, you know, and he certainly has shared personal stories in his music a lot over the years. But this record, it's so vulnerable and revealing. It's the kind of music that just made me rethink everything I thought I knew about him as a person and an artist. The song you're playing.
Yeah. Before I say goodbye, my star in the sky. Such a funny thought.
Steven, get a hanky for Robin. We're going to call it a show. Thank you, Marissa.
Thank
Actually,
you
can use your cape.
Yeah, exactly.
This is fun. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From NPR Music, let's go out on Sufjan Stevens. It's All Songs Considered.
Make the most of your life while it is rife, while it is light. While you do enough talk, my little hawk, why do you cry? Tell me, what did you learn from the Tillamook burn or the 4th of July? We're all gonna die. We're all good.